Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love. In Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
Through the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. And on the off chance that anyone can hear me, this is Tim Hayes. We're a little bit late getting things started here. And today is Friday. It's a Friday in August, early in August. Oh, what is it? Probably the 8th. And we're here today to try and continue the journey of learning about and spreading the news of ancient Aramaic tool of forgiveness. And I believe we have Dale Allen Hoffman here with us today to continue the Aramaic Fridays, most Fridays in 2014. Dale, are you there?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Ah, good. Yeah, I was busy doing a bunch of stuff, and like the time for the show came and went, and I didn't even think about it until later at night in the shower. I was like, wow, which was amazing because I even saw a post about Mind Shifters Radio like right maybe an hour before the show, and it still didn't click for me. It was so weird. It just went right out of my mind. But anyway, hopefully
it
was a good show.
It ended up being perfect. It was somebody was able to get a good piece of work done and demonstrate the process of being in the moment and staying with the tools so that a lot of the anger and fear and tension can get released from our lives. Mm. So what's been happening in your world in the past few weeks?
I'm sitting in the car. My family is in a restaurant. We're in Virginia on our way to New Jersey and New York. Well, I've had a very productive couple of weeks. You know what was really interesting? I called Michael after an interview. I think it was on Wednesday that I did. And I didn't think about the fact, of course, even then, that he was going to be on the radio when I called, and I was like, oops, I forgot about that. But yeah, I did was asked to do a show, and it was just a very interesting experience because right from the beginning, before we even got going, the host said, I want to let you know I feel honored to be on the show. And he started laughing, and he said, well, we'll see what you think once it gets going. And I just thought it was a joke. And, it ended up turning into like I'm not sure what it was. It was like some sort of an interesting egomaniacal bash. It was a really strange thing, which was even weirder because when we would go on the commercial breaks, he was coming and trying to smooth me over, and then we'd go back out on the air, and then he would start, tearing things apart again. It was interesting, too, because during one of the breaks, he told me he was also interested in having, Michael Rice and Albert LaChance on the show, and I was like, well, I don't know if that's going to happen at this point, but it was really strange. I mean, I would say things, and he would, it was kind of like a communication, did you hear what I think I said, where I would say something very specific, and then he would rephrase it and completely change the context. It was an interesting experience, and I mean, I found myself doing sort of real-time forgiveness the whole time, like constantly coming back to my breath and coming back to removing the realities that I could actually feel were being sort of not only resonated, but even new ones being implanted during the process. So, I mean, I learned a lot in that sort of real-time healing or real-time forgiveness, what I often call it. Interesting experience, though. Very odd and strange, and I was even contacted actually by someone that I don't even know who they are afterward that sent me a link to some quotes from this guy that where he just, I guess that's what he does. He bashes people. So I came through. I mean, I felt, you know, pretty good at the end of it. I was kind of wondering what its purpose was, but anyway. Yeah, interesting experience.
So how did you get connected with a person like that?
Well, they contacted me actually about a year ago, and I think it was one of those things where I opened up the email and then forgot about it, you know, didn't reply immediately. And then I went, and it's interesting. I think it was supposed to happen the way it did, obviously, because I had downloaded a couple of this guy's shows about maybe 6 months ago, but I never listened to them before I was on the show. My intent was to listen to one, or at least one, if not two, you know, to get a feel for the show. And I don't know, I didn't. So it was interesting because, I mean, he calls himself a rabbi. And the interesting thing was that, there was so much sarcasm that was just downright strange. There was a lot of really heavy, like, sarcasm, and there was a lot of experiences of, he would ask a question, and then as soon as I would start answering, he would just tear it apart. It was amazing. I mean, some of the statements that came out that day were that one was that it didn't matter what the Aramaic meant in if Jesus was quoting the Old Testament. All that mattered was if he was quoting something from the Hebrew Bible, all that would matter would be the what people today think is what the Hebrew, you know, translation or meanings of those words meant. That was an interesting statement. Another interesting statement was I was talking about, like, love your neighbor as yourself, and I talked about how Archdeacon Shamoon from the Assyrian Church of the East, in the translation of the Koboris, actually, several decades ago, they had this issue when they were translating the word neighbor because most of the scholars were saying, hey, wait a second, neighbor just means the person next to you. And they were also saying, you know, in that time even, it was probably really just Jews that a Jew would not consider a non-Jew to be a neighbor. And when I mentioned that, you know, the Archdeacon had said, hey, wait a second here, first century Judean and Galilean Aramaic, neighbor, Carib, meant anyone you think of, including yourself. And it was an interesting thing because the guy literally said that that wouldn't have mattered what the Aramaic meant. All that mattered was that since he was quoting the Hebrew Bible, that it just meant, you know, somebody next to you, and most likely just a Jew. And it was interesting because my reply to that was, I said, well, of course, that I would think that is why he put the parable of the Good Samaritan right after love your neighbor as yourself, because the Samaritan, of course, was a non-Jew. The Jews actually called the Samaritans the swines or the pigs, as they often did sometimes to common Aramaic speakers. They were often called swine or pigs. And I believe that he put the parable of the Good Samaritan there to say, hey, wait a second, here's a Jew, you know, beaten on the side of the road, starving, and, you know, heavily wounded and weak on the side of the road, and he's passed up by, you know, one Jew after another. And it ends up being a Samaritan that were constantly dumped on by Judaism, that ends up stopping to nurse his wounds and getting him a room for the night and a place to stay and something to eat. And he didn't agree. So, you know, it was an interesting thing.
Well, not everybody agrees with Yeshua. That's very clear. That's why we have a lot of the craziness and violence and wars that we do in our world. Well, we're glad to have you here. And, we just lost Dale. So while we're waiting for Dale to come back on, the primary purpose for this radio show 5 days a week is to introduce people to and then support them in using the tool of forgiveness, which comes from an ancient Aramaic understanding of what Yeshua said in his native tongue. And the primary difference between the term forgiveness in the ancient Aramaic and the term forgiveness as the Greeks translated it and then it's been passed down to us is that forgiveness really has nothing to do with anybody else. It only has to do with me. It has to do with what's going on inside of me and what I'm creating from the thoughts that I choose and the emotions that those thoughts create. And when I'm feeling anything less than loving or calm or peaceful or joyful, I'm creating that. And if I don't like that sensation, we're presenting a tool which allows anyone to go in to their own mind-body energy system and remove whatever they don't want, whatever is less than love, whatever is less than joy and aliveness. And the other day we were talking with Dale about, or with Michael about, the phrase where Yeshua said, I come to give you life and give it more abundantly. And Dale's translation for that word is Chaim, and it means more accurately than just life. It means energy. So are you back with us, Dale?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm not sure what happened. I just kind of dropped. So.
And I was just talking about, you know, the term that was used when the statement was made, I come to give you life and give it more abundantly. And maybe you could say a little bit about that word.
Oh, absolutely. Chaya is an interesting word because it's a word that's translated not only as life, just literal, it's conscious life energy. It is translated as life. It's translated in the modernized interpretations of the Jesus teachings. It's the same word as salvation or save, which is interesting because salvation and save are both very European understandings of what was really being said in the first century, because he was literally saying, you know, not about being saved from something, not about some kind of a salvation. It's just coming back to that true source or that true, you know, what Joseph Rael, Beautiful Painted Arrow, he calls it the ground of consciousness, which I love, that natural actuality, the groundedness of being. And, of course, coming to give you life and give it abundantly when it's conscious life energy, that's not meaning that you're going to live longer or some sort of bizarre thought about some sort of quasi-human life lived in some kind of eternity, but it's rather realizing that you are eternity itself, the no beginning and no ending. You are the consciousness or the energy of life itself. And, wow, that really opens up. And it's actually related to the term chai, which not only is a tea, but you find that in several more Eastern languages, chai, which is sometimes pronounced chai and sometimes pronounced chai. Interesting.
Well, that was right in line with what I've gotten from several of your CDs and the word DVD, so I appreciate that clarification. It really has been panning out in my life lately that when I'm off the mark in my thoughts and I'm feeling an anger or a fear, it really does deplete my available energy. And that's how I've been using this recently, is to just realize I have so much more ability to function and think clearly when I'm coming from a calm, centered space, some would call it loving, than when I'm blaming or angry. And so
that's a huge lesson. I mean, that's, you know, that was, I believe, was the biggest lesson of my interview the other day, was this, you know, constantly, every time I could feel the resonance of something starting to emerge, to be as conscious of it as I could in that moment and let it go. And there was a couple of times that I did kind of go blotto, you know, and I could feel it. You can feel the heat come on. And you can feel yourself become sort of provocative and sort of like a leaning forward, leaning outward, you know, sort of like puffing up, which is interesting because the word ape or mask or veil or hypocrite means to puff out at the mouth, to puff up. And that's what happens. That's where arrogance comes in. It's actually a protection mechanism where the fear flips into hostility. And what I really believe is hostility is fear projected outward, and fear is generally projected inward toward ourselves, and fear projected outward would manifest to look like hostility. And it's an interesting thing when you can be conscious enough to see it happening as it's happening and to have been in the process long enough to be able to actually use it real time like that. It's just an amazing way to live.
Yeah, and as we've talked about a couple times in the past couple weeks, that people ask me, why do I do the radio show, and why do I do the group, and why do I do these things? And I say, because I need to keep this material top of mind. Because I've learned by experience that when I drift away from keeping it top of mind, I fall back into the old habits. And just the other day, it was either Monday or Tuesday morning, I found myself in the middle of a lot of turbulence, moving in office and a lot of things going, you know, in ways other than the way that I had planned. And I found myself walking around thinking, this is idiotic. And after about the third or fourth time, when the energy behind the word idiotic got so strong I could feel it, I just thought, okay, when in my life have I been idiotic that I'm still blaming myself for? And I just took a few deep breaths, and I felt the energy shift almost immediately. When I focused on myself and what I've done that I'm not proud of or that has led to disruption in my life, all of a sudden my energy shifted. And I just stayed with the breath, and there's an energy tapping technique that I know to do, and I started doing it. And as soon as I did that, I became aware of rage. And I had this image of myself smashing a light fixture because we're in the move and there was just recently a light fixture involved. So I just kept tapping and breathing, and within minutes, it shifted. And I was back on track. I was back in a loving state, and I could see, well, you know, it's silly for me to get angry at other people because they're not doing what I haven't been able to do much of the time in my life.
Well, that's beautiful. You know, that brought up, like for me the other day, it brought up some of the things that were resonating up was the not good enough or the feeling of somehow being judged, feeling that somehow there was judgment, and almost like it was a recognition of almost like calling it in, the psychic megaphone, interesting experience. And I noticed that those moments when I was able to do that, to just pop that bubble and release that and really let it go, that I was able to open up. And then there was times when I was, you know, feeling more of a triggering, but I wasn't so much letting go. I was trying to get my point across regardless of how many times I was being cut off, and you know, that I would sort of, it would go off on a tangent. And yeah, like you said, you lose the center. The groundedness is gone, and there's a puffing out. It's coming more from what's resonating, less from the light that's at the center. It's more from bushel baskets than anything else.
Well, and somebody recently sent me something from Guy Finley where he said, I am not, he's talking about a reconciliation between self-condemnation and excuse. And he says, I am not condemned for anything, and I am not excused from anything. What's needed, the new action, is a non-action which allows a stillness and greater clarity still. And that's what I found myself doing by returning to the breath and then doing some of that energy tapping and then thinking, okay, when have I done the very thing I'm upset with this other person for doing? And then holding a space of love for myself and the other person, and the energy just melted away.
Yeah. A beautiful lesson. Especially when you can actually, in the moment, course, in hindsight, there's one thing, but to be able to do that in the moment, it's a beautiful lesson.
Well, and that's my answer to people when they say, why do you do the radio show 5 days a week, and why do you do the support group, and why do you, you know, teach these tools in your practice? The answer is right there. I want to be able to do that more and more often in the moment. And what I've learned the hard way is, unless I practice and keep it top of mind, I'm not able to do it in the moment.
I feel that the same with true finding true balance without sort of pulling too deep into the negativity. In other words, to have a positive disposition without actually stuffing down the things that would pull you out of the present moment. Something like that would be resonating. And it's an interesting thing because there's so much of a sort of false positivity that's out in the world. Like, put on the fake smile and the fake plastic face and, like, positive, 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 but there's not a lot of balance in that. But yet, by the same token, when you start digging into those things, like getting deep into resonance and even deep into forgiveness, sometimes if you forget the actual process itself and you're looking at things without actually removing them, then that negativity, the old habits, the old patterns can start setting in. Sort of like you remove demons and new ones come in to take their place. And that's where it's so important at the end of the worksheet to reset, not only to reset the positive goal, but to constantly make that statement, the declaration of holding love conscious, active, and present. Because that's what it is. It's not a lot of people, just a lot of people I've heard, like a lot of people over the years, sort of some of the more, you know, to say imbalanced sort of fake positivity type thing, sort of really go, oh, well, that Michael Rice guy, why is this happening to me again? He's just talking about everything that's bad, without actually ever read the book, never been to a workshop, never done a worksheet, etc. And I'm like, actually, this is exactly the opposite of that. This is about removing those bushel baskets that are over the natural light. It's not about trying to somehow put some sort of new bushel basket on that's not true light, that's not true awareness or conscious, active, present love. It actually is revealing the conscious, active, and present love that's already there. It's revealing the Chaya, that conscious, active life energy, the presence, rather than putting on some sort of fake life on top of it that you need to be saved from or into or have some kind of salvation. The salvation or the saving, if anything, is removing that root of your suffering, taking the bushel basket off of that light, so that you can reel that what you've been looking for the whole time is you. It's what you are looking for is what is looking. That's really it's not even really a magic, but it's what it seems like sometimes. It seems like a magic process when you really get it, whether it's something small or something huge. It's a great awakening, moment by moment.
Well, that just brings to mind the idea. It came up once earlier this week on the show, the difference between, if there is a word for judgment, and from the ancient Aramaic where they were talking about judgment, what's been useful for me is to begin to talk with people about catching myself when I'm in judgment, which usually results in some form of fear or hostility, and looking for shifting to a place of acceptance. And the word I've started to use lately is discernment. You know, I can discern the difference between a red pillow and a blue pillow without having to judge that one is better than the other. Is there?
You know, we actually covered that on the show a couple of weeks ago. I don't want to cut you off, but I'll get back to that, yeah.
No, I was just going to say, is there something from the ancient Aramaic that, because there is so much that comes down through the Bible about you're going to be judged, and there's the term, you know, be careful what you judge another, lest
you
be judged.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know that you were, I think it was one of the weeks that you called in the beginning, and I'm not sure if you were on the call, even if you were even on it at all, actually, but I don't remember, I'm trying to think of the two actual Aramaic words themselves, and they're not coming to mind, but there's the judgment such as that, in which you judge another, you are guilty of practicing. Of course, we call them the hypocrite. But then there was also a different word for judgment that showed up later in some of Paul's letters. And the word that Paul used, of course, Paul, Saul of Tarsus, was an Aramaic speaker. And the word that he used meant something exactly, you know, the word that I used was discernment. It was something closer to exactly like you were saying about the pillows. This one's red, this one's blue, whatever it may be. It's discernment. Whereas the word that Yeshua used in about judging one another, trying to remember the exact definition that the lexicon popped up, but it was essentially not so much a discernment, so much as you are looking at something and you're judging it as right and wrong, that somehow it's wrong. And it's an interesting thing, too, because, like you say, that in which you judge another, you are guilty of practicing. Even if you look at that, which sounds kind of strange, in a positive light, that in which you judge another, you are not necessarily guilty of practicing, but, you know, you practice yourself. Let's put it that way. It's a little closer to the Aramaic. Not guilty in terms of something bad, but just what you see in the other is what's in you. And what you see as positive in another is what's positive in you. What you see as negative in another, of course, is what's negative in you. And just to be able to recognize that, and it's a big place to get to because, yeah, judgment is so heavy, especially when looking at the Hebrew Bible. People really, I think, need to have to be well-versed. You know, if you want to go through the entire Holy Bible, understand that a lot of what's in the Old Testament is not necessarily what Yeshua, I believe, was trying to communicate. I believe that's why he was taking common, everyday, belief systems in Judaism, such as, you know, what does neighbor mean, just the person next to you or only a Jew, and saying, hey, wait a second here, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something that's much more universal and cosmic, and that's why he gives us that parable of the Good Samaritan to say, guess what, it's not just the person next to you, it's not just the Jew, it's anyone, including those that we judge as being somehow less or better than us in any way whatsoever. And it's an interesting thing how even seeing that with the parable there, not everybody's going to be able to pick that up, that your neighbor is literally anyone you think of, including yourself. Regardless of quoting, you know, a scripture, a Hebrew scripture from the Hebrew Bible, that doesn't mean that his using that scripture is going to bind that scripture into the belief systems and the ideologies and the theologies of the people that wrote it. We can take these, we can open them up, we can bring them back into the heart, bring them back into a greater light, and use teachings that may somehow be limited in some kind of theology or religious ideology, and we can unpack them and we can live them with much greater capacities without essentially dumbing them down to the way people used to think about them. And I really believe that's a lot of what Yeshua was doing, was taking very common everyday phrases that people looked at in a certain ideological way and cracking the shell of that and letting that essence and the light that was within the heart of those very common sayings to come out and to live through us in a way that was much more universal than the way they had been lived before that.
Well, it just keeps deepening as a process for me, and I've had a lot of people come through the support group and listen to the lectures with Dr. Rice and then come away saying, well, they're telling me that my emotions are wrong and they're bad and that judgment is bad. And what I've come to more recently is if I look at things like what I judge of another I have been guilty of doing, I can use that just like I use regulatory speech. Whenever I get angry at somebody else, I come back to one of my favorite phrases, which is, I will never be upset about anything anybody else ever says or does, unless I'm still judging myself negatively for having done the same or similar things. So now it's like a Geiger counter that can go off and let me know whenever I get upset that somebody else is being idiotic, as, you know, was my most recent episode. That means there's unresolved judgment of myself for doing things that were not so smart or that ended badly or that made a mess of something. And then I can look inside myself, apply the tools, and be free of it. It's a fabulous feedback system if I know how to use it rather than go on the wild goose chase. Yeah, and if you use it, rather than go on the wild goose chase.
That's the other importance of keeping it up at the top of your mind, because the further down it sinks, the less you use it, And then, of course, you look at it and say, well, it probably didn't work anyway. You totally and completely forget about it entirely, you know. The door never closes, though, once it opens, I believe. Not entirely. Even if you're not putting it into practice, it's still there.
Yeah, and the other thing that we were talking about a few weeks ago is if I think I'm supposed to get done as a person or with an issue, then I'm going to get really, really frustrated with this work. But if I realize I'm never done and every moment is new and life is really about being fully awake and aware in each moment, which is, you know, what some people would call a better definition of eternity rather than the way my mind would create a picture of time that goes on and on and on endlessly. But if I'm awake and aware, fully awake and aware in the moment, that has to happen every moment. And that's where life really is for me.
You know, that's the satori of, in the Eastern philosophies, satori is instant enlightenment. And we in the West, so often we think of enlightenment as some kind of destination or thing that happens, and it's like the pinnacle, the peak of the mountain, and now all of a sudden you're done. When satori doesn't mean an instant enlightenment as some kind of a destination, okay, now you're done, you can just walk on and, you know, walk around like a shining light bulb. What that actually means is one moment of awakening where you have a moment where you're open and you're fully present, you're fully conscious in the moment, you've reached what Yeshua called in Matthew 28:20, the end of time, which, as you say, it's not some linear fashion thing in my head in some kind of masculine way that just spins out or on and on and on and on. It's actually a full presence in the moment, what Yeshua also called in the Lord's Prayer, Yal Mana, the mana, or the presence, that essential energy of the moment, the lachma of the moment, the bread, the sustenance, the realization, the insight. And that's it. I mean, enlightenment is now, and it's not a destination. It's not a process. It's the end of some kind of path. It's a moment of absolute forgiveness, and you've removed the roots that are sufficient unto this moment are the evils thereof. You could say sufficient unto this moment are the issues of resonance thereof. Whatever it is that's resonating, if you just take it moment by moment, that's enlightenment. You remove the veil that's in this moment. If you're in another moment, you realize you're not in that moment fully, consciously in your mind. You remove that veil. You remove the next 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 veil. And the more you do that, you know, it may seem like you're barely scratching the surface, but all of a sudden those open moments start to widen and the gap gets a little bit wider. And those moments of satori, the enlightenment gets, maybe it lasts for 2 seconds instead of 1 second, though I would sort of resist judging or shy away from judging it as some sort of linear thing in that fashion. But you notice that you keep doing the work and you keep doing the work, and in the beginning it looks like, you know, all hell is breaking loose and you can't seem to see a way out. After a while, there is a little bit less, and there's less bushel baskets in the moment. And if you keep that at the top of your mind, you keep it, like you're saying, you know, sort of right there at the surface of your heart, it gets a little bit easier and a little bit easier and a little bit easier, or should I say just a little bit more clear. I don't know if easy is exactly the word. And that enlightenment, you know, the now becomes a wider moment. It becomes much more far-reaching. And it sort of sneaks up on you sometimes where all of a sudden you realize that you're just in the right place at the right time. You're tuv, you're right there in the bullseye. You're not off the target, but you're right on it. And the reason you're right on it is because you've let go of whatever that desire was for the moment. Whatever the goal was, you let it go so that you could just let the moment birth through you. And that, to me, is the essential. It's like the essential core of forgiveness, and it's why I'm so incredibly grateful for that. And it's also why I think some people have such a resistance when I talk about, you know, what I feel are the Yeshua teachings and the way that they birth through me. Some people really have issues with that, and I realize that it's not an issue with me. It's an issue with their belief systems. It's an issue with their theologies and their ideologies. And the further I go down the road, the more I realize that. And I realize that if that's resonating something for me and I feel that irritation, that means that's mine to remove. It's just a great awakening. But, yeah, it happens moment by moment, now by now.
Yeah, I love the way Way of Mastery talks about it as forgiveness being just a lovely energy to live within. And at another point, it talks about how if you are an infinite, growing, expansive being of light and consciousness, then how could you ever be done knowing yourself?
Wow.
So I really get, you know, as I was listening to you, I really got a little bit of a click in about how in the Western mind we really do talk so much about enlightenment as a destination. And that if in this moment I can live and act lovingly and in that energy of forgiveness, and in the next moment I choose anger or judgment or rage, then there's more work to do. Maybe not for 100,000 years to come, but at least in this next moment, to choose to teach only love, to choose to think only loving thoughts and extend that energy of love that I am. I think it was Stuart Wilde in one of his books, he said, I get so tired of people telling me, oh, you should meet my guru, he's enlightened. And he said, give me 1 week with that person living in their family of origin, and I'll show you who's enlightened and who's not.
Stewie was a very dear friend of mine, and he that to me is something I say quite often when I'm out on the road, and it's in lots of my CDs. I say, you can talk about your enlightenment while you're on the mountaintop all you want. If you want to find out what enlightenment means, you need to put them down in exactly that, down into the family situation, down into the real world. You know, what Stuart would call the grossness of matter, sort of like you're walking around the edge of a swimming pool, and then all of a sudden you get down into the thick, sluggishness almost of the water. And, you know, we're here in this sort of what seems to be a physical realm, and things move slower. You don't just think and pop, here it is in your hand, not the average person. And it's being able to learn those manifestation processes, the forgiveness process, the removal of the bushel baskets. You're in the swimming pool while things are moving, you know, only a bit more slow, because those are sort of tied in with some of this physicality, so that when you do get back out of that physical body, all of a sudden now you've got a much more richly enhanced nuance of understanding of what those processes really are, because you've been able to see them broken down, almost slowed down in front of you. Like when I was learning to play guitar when I was 12, 13 years old, I would do it with vinyl records, and they were 33 and a third. And I would take my my turntable, and I would slow my 33 and a third records down to 16, which was what those really old records were on, 16. And I could learn these guitar solos basically at almost exactly half speed. And the other interesting thing is, by clicking it into half speed, the guitar, the pitch of the guitar would drop almost exactly one octave. So I could learn these guitar solos, lower down the register on the guitar, and sometimes even write those down, and then I would transpose them into a higher vibration, into a higher key that was exactly one octave higher. And then, of course, when I would learn them up there, since I had heard them at half speed at a lower octave, I was able to get a much more fundamental understanding of each of the individual notes, the phrasing, the way that they were being picked, the kind of space between the notes, all the different sort of vibrato and things like that, so that when I did transpose it into something that was much faster and a much higher vibration, I had a much more rich handle on it, because I had it down there in the grossness of matter, and I learned it at a lower speed, a lower rate of vibration, and then I stepped it up, which is, to me, what real-time healing is. It's living right now in this present moment, and that's what's happening. You're in a higher octave, you know, it's a higher rate of vibration that's going through the process much quicker. But when you're doing it step by step, moment by moment, in what seems to be a slower and a lower octave, that's where you sort of put down the roots and get into that deeper truth, so that when the stuff does hit the fan, you're able to do it right then and right there, moment by moment, in that process. And that, to me, is almost like human life in a nutshell, is that sort of the grossness of matter. And a lot of that insight I got from Stuart Wilde, as a matter of fact, so... Yeah.
Yeah, as you were talking, I was thinking about, it just resonated for me several times how people have talked about in the support group environment, and we have one person who has said a couple times, he ends up being more honest even with himself when he's in the group than he is honest with himself when he's at home. There's that loving, supportive environment, and people can bring an issue in and ask for help in processing through the worksheet process and get that practice when they're not under fire out in the world at work or at home or with the person who's actually pushing their button. And then if they practice that enough at that slower speed, as you're talking about, I have found when I practice that at that slower speed, that's been translating more and more into these real-life situations where I catch myself sooner and sooner when the fear or the anger or the confusion gets stirred up in me.
Wow. Beautiful.
So our number is 646-200-4169 if you have a question. We have a number of callers on. If you have a question and you're sitting there on hold, feel free to press the number 1. That'll let us know you've got a question for Dale. We've got 14 minutes left, and I, for one, have a lot of gratitude resonating in me for your being here, Dale, and for this show and this support network. And I'm holding the space as I say that everything is well with Michael and Jeannie, because I didn't hear anything from them about not being able to be on the show today, and I know they were, they're in the middle of yet another intensive. They're in the intensive season down there in Heartland. So here's someone with their hand up, 970, you're in the air.
Hi, this is Cindy, Pagosa Springs, Colorado.
Hello, Cindy.
Hi.
Hi,
Dale and Dr. Tim. I've actually got two questions, but I'll just ask one, and if there's time. It's my question is, I hear you describing what it's like to be in real time with someone who's actively triggering you. And I hear you describe that you use the tools. But my question is, if one or both of you could go into your mind and try to recall those moments, and what actually is in your mind when you are processing in the moment so that you don't give in to the negative stuff that the person is resonating in you? What does that really feel like when you're doing that? When you're on the spot, especially on a radio show, that's got to be just the ultimate
It's an interesting experience. You know, for me, I sort of scratched the surface by saying that, you know, before I got to that recognition process, you know, essentially that I was losing it, I could feel the heat coming on. You know, I could feel heat in my face, my neck, my arms, etc. And I noticed that if something was coming up, and of course I'm pointing at him, at the host, I would start to lean in, and I would start to get more forceful with what I was saying. I'd become more provocative, I think was the word, as in like sort of leaning forward, trying to somehow make some kind of headway. But as the call would go on further and further, what would happen, I would actually get to the middle of a sentence, and I would just have that fleeting thought that would be basically, Dale, let go. And I would let go, and I'd literally stop several times mid-sentence, and I just stopped in the middle of the thought, and I breathed. And what happened when I first started breathing is it actually burns a little bit more at first. But what happens is I allowed it to sort of, it's almost like a tomato, the way I also often liken it in a lot of my gatherings is, it's almost like you're, when we're lost in the resonance, we're squeezing this tomato or like an egg almost to the point of cracking, and we've got all that tension and pressure on it, but we're somehow trying to keep it from cracking. I believe what the keeping it from cracking really is not flipping out and going crazy, But in truth, I think what that is we just don't realize that we don't have to squeeze it until it explodes. All we need to really do is let go, and it'll take care of itself. And what happened is, you know, when I would take those breaths, I would feel that intensifying heat. I literally would feel the heat. And by stopping like that, taking the breath, it would get even more intense. And I'm talking like a split second. And I would be right in that breath, like much like Tim was saying, with tapping, and all of a sudden, pop. It just pops. It's gone. And you know what was the most interesting thing about that for me in that sort of real-time process, especially like that on the radio, is when it pops, whatever the goal was that I had for that moment, whatever the thought I was trying to communicate to this, to the person, whoever that person is in front of me, whether it's in this situation or whatever, the thought that I was trying to get across to them, I realized I didn't have the goal to make them understand it anymore. And also on top of it, you realize that you're actually talking to yourself. You're telling yourself something you need to hear. And it was an amazing thing because it's almost like speeding down the highway when it's in those situations. It's happening. It seems like it's happening so fast, but yet at the same time, when you've done the process thousands of times, and of course not every time are you doing it perfectly executed, but even the more you do it, it's kind of like I was saying about a guitar solo, that after I practiced the same thing thousands of times, even when those notes were coming through really fast, I was somehow more aware of each distinct note, each tone, each inflection, the space between the notes. And I sort of felt that, well, very much felt that in this, that I felt it sort of peter out. And I noticed that the more I did that and the more I was letting go and just being open in the moment, the less I felt like I needed to somehow prove or get something across or meet some kind of goal, because I had finally just let go and let it flow through. And I just let it be what it was. You know, I was able to be in the moment.
Well, Dale, when you were slowing down the record player to 16 and you were practicing those guitar solos, were you doing that on stage with thousands of people watching you?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No way. Of course. Wow, what a beautiful aspect to bring into the conversation.
So the key is we don't do this. It's like what Dr. Ray says when he gives the YGAN workshop. He says, please pick a subject for your first worksheet that's got a very low upset level. Yeah, if you pick something that in the moment you're upset at an 8 or a 10 or a 37 out of 10, then it's not going to take you too long to realize these worksheets don't work. You know, he says, if you take a 12-year-old girl who wants to learn baseball and you give her a baseball bat and you put her at home plate, and you put the Cy Young Award winner throwing 95-mile-an-hour fastballs at her, how long do you think it's going to take her to decide you simply can't hit that little ball with that little bat?
Wow.
Right? It's not going to take her long at all. But the fact of the matter is people can and do hit that little ball with that bat, but they do it after years of practice. So, Cindy, the key here is to be practicing this, to come back after you've been triggered and use the worksheet process and the breath work, and then practice that living it through again, going through and doing exactly what Dale said, realizing it's all an inside job. And if I'm upset because somebody else is mad at me or not doing what I want them to do, or because they were disrespectful, or because they went back on their word, or whatever it is, the only way I could be upset about that is if I'm still judging myself negatively for having done the same or similar thing. Mm. And when I take a breath and I go back, I get out of the situation where I was triggered, and I apply the tools, I start building the skills, just like the 12-year-old girl who's going to learn how to hit a baseball. She starts building the skills so that one day she can hit a 95-mile-an-hour fastball.
What part does visual eye contact have to play in all that? I find that when I'm really intently trying to listen to someone or concentrate, I like to close my eyes. And I know to some that is an insult. So when either of you are in that moment, what are you doing with your eyes? Are you closing your eyes?
I would say, you know, that's an interesting, that's such an amazing, awesome question. When I'm on a, if I'm, if, like as an example on the radio show, my eyes were most definitely closed when I was in that process. And that's kind of actually something normal when you, when I sort of go into sort of deeper aspects of something that I'm saying in a radio thing or even live, I tend to close my eyes. But what's interesting is, and this is something that, like when you say some people may be offended by that, obviously that would be their thing, but yet at the same time, one of the things that I do in many of my gatherings, my workshop, is I have people sit across from each other, including strangers, and we actually do several different breath processes and meditation and different kinds of things while actually keeping engaged. And it's I think it's not a technique that I think like that you should do one particular thing in every circumstance. What I would almost say is even including in front of someone, there's times that I close my eyes and there's times that I just stick to it and I keep not locked on them, but I do engage and I do stay visually connected with them. But I will say this, the visual connection, if someone's like early on in the forgiveness process, the visual connection and maintaining that visual connection, especially if it's someone that's not really intimate, like a friend or family or something, someone that's almost like a stranger, staying connected can somehow, in some ways, trigger that sort of provocative nature I was talking about as well, where we almost use it, we can fall into some kind of offensive, and I don't mean offensive as in offending the person, but sort of coming out and somehow pushing ourselves outward, leaning into it, somehow using it as some sort of power mechanism. But if you're, what I'm saying is if you're able to keep your eyes open and stay engaged and look at them, and I would say it, as much as you're able to not look away, but to keep the eye contact, but you've got to remember to keep breathing. I really feel that some of the greatest awakenings that I've ever had, that I've ever seen with other people in a lot of my gatherings, were ones when they were engaged like that, and they kept the eye contact going, and they just literally breathed through the process. And I would say it's not really like I always do this or I always do that, but I will say that in terms of on the radio show and on radio shows, my eyes are generally closed, but in an everyday conversation, that's not always happening. So that's a really, really good question. Wow.
Well, while I'm listening to you, I'm remembering that so often a parent disciplining a child will say, look at me, look at me. And why are they, why? Why is it so important that the child look at them at that horrible moment when the last thing the child wants to do is look at them? Is that a power thing?
I think it can really be, and I think what it is in so many ways that that's really like me as a parent. I think it's almost like it's almost like demanding some sort of respect, and I would absolutely say that it goes right back to the root of something that happened in my childhood, of me feeling like maybe I wasn't being listened to, whatever that may be. I think if it comes out in such a way like that, I would definitely say that that person's got an issue with it. Now, if someone was saying, I would really love to support you. Can you please take my hand and can we keep our eyes connected? Can we, you know, keep connected here and keep looking into each other's eyes? That's much different than that sort of look at me, you know. And we've all done it. So especially if you're a parent.
Yeah. I don't know if there's time for my second question, but I'll ask it real quickly. I'm wondering what in the Aramaic translation of what your work has taken you to, it says about satire. Brad and I talk a lot about satire because that was used really heavily on him as a child. And
so do you mean sarcasm?
Sarcasm, yes. What did I say?
Satire. Okay,
Cynthia,
I have to cut you off because we're out of time. But
right,
that's a great question. I'm sure we can hit that with Dr. Rice and maybe a week from now, Dale, when you're back, if you want to look into the sarcasm word. But please join us again Monday through Friday next week and try to make this just just a fabulous life for yourself and give the world the best gift you can. Have the best year yet of your eternal life. And thank you all for being here.